Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Edward Kelly, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, you have anything to chat about this evening?
No, I am anxious to get to our illustrious guest, but we're going to bring him on a little earlier. But I wanted to mention, I don't know when I printed this article, but I just, you know, came across it on my desk, and it dates back to the time of the horrible shooting in Las Vegas. And it's quite interesting. I'm going to read the article, and we can just see what your thoughts are. The Vegas shooting victim's husband says his wife visited him in a dream to tell him not to take her off life support. A husband whose wife was critically injured during the Las Vegas shooting on October 1st says she visited him in a dream and told him everything would be okay. Months later, she miraculously headed home from the hospital. And this gentleman, his name is Frank, and his wife, Giovanna, they were attending the Harvest Music Festival to celebrate Frank's safe return from deployment in the Middle East. When the unthinkable happened, his wife, Giovanna, was struck in the head by a bullet that ended up lodged in her spinal cord after the gunman rained bullets down on Las Vegas Village, killing 58 concertgoers and injuring hundreds more. Giovanna was rushed to the hospital, where doctors gave Frank a grim prognosis. In the days and weeks following the attack, surgeons asked the family to think about removing Giovanna from life support, an option they considered until Frank says he was visited by his wife in a dream. I had a dream that Giovanna visited me, and she hugged me and kissed me and told me everything was going to be okay. She walked away, and then I called her mom and said, "We're keeping Giovanna alive. She's going to be all right." And miraculously, Giovanna did wake up from a coma, and 18 days later, she was transferred home from the hospital in Phoenix. And slowly but surely, she began regaining her strength and was able to walk with the help of an exoskeleton by Christmas time. On January 24th, Giovanna was finally able to go home in what surgeons refer to as a profound and amazing recovery. He says that he's extremely thankful that he did not heed the words of the physicians who told his family that Giovanna would probably never recover. So that raises a pretty interesting thing. We're always hearing these reports about having these dream visits from the deceased, but here is his wife was in a coma and was able to get a message to him telepathically that she was going to be okay. Pretty interesting, right?
It's extremely interesting. And it also points, so I just want to take the other point of view for a while, but it also points to the fact that if our physicians would become more attuned to the possibility of survival of consciousness, then they would be more open to this. I mean, every single doctor on the face of this earth has one story or another about a patient doing something, quote unquote, miraculous. Now, if you take all of those stories, just one story, and I'm sure many of them have many stories, one story from each of those doctors, you've got thousands, if not millions, of stories out there that are miracles.
Yeah, and the doctors refer to them, as they, as this doctor said, you know, amazing and profound and so forth. But I was really more interested in the mechanism by, you know, how this happened, because there's a lot of explanations. You know, one, you know, her his wife's, you know, consciousness, which was very much, you know, alive, even though her body was in a coma, was able to send the telepathic message. Another might interpret as maybe... maybe there was a discarnate involvement, you know, maybe a deceased relative was helping out, you know, and maybe it was the relative that got the message, you know, through, you know, and not, you know.
She was identified in the dream, though.
Yeah. And, you know,
and the fact that she was in a coma allows her consciousness to leave its body. I mean, you hear this even in cases of child abuse, where the children will talk about leaving their bodies. So there is that mechanism, and we hear about it a lot, where when the physical body is being hurt or impaired suddenly at some point, that the soul is able to leave the body, detach from the body, so that there's, and I know we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago on the radio show, there's no pain.
Right.
No pain.
You know, so, and then, you know, it raises the question, you know, so how did she know, you know, that she was going to be okay? And how did she know that her body was, you know, was going to recover and that she was going to come out of the coma and wake up? How does one know that?
Because when you're on the other side, there's no time and space and everything happens at the same time, past, present, and future.
Just she was straddling both worlds. I'll buy that.
Either you're in the physical world or you're not. Those are your two choices, and she was not.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad we got that straightened out. And so we're going to go to a break a little bit earlier, and we're going to get Dr. Ed Kelly on the line. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
The Camlach Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlach Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death, and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlach.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love Knows No Death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net. Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Those just tuning in, our guest this evening is Dr. Ed Kelly. Our sponsor tonight is the Comlock Center, and they could be found on the web at comlock.com. Bob?
And we're happy to have Dr. Ed Kelly. Ed did his undergraduate work at Yale University, where he studied psychology, graduated magna cum laude, got his PhD from Harvard University, spent the next 15-plus years working mainly in parapsychology, initially at J.B. Rhines Institute for Parapsychology, and then for 10 years through the Department of Electrical Engineering at Duke, and finally through a private research institute at Chapel Hill. He's now returned to his central long-term research interest, which is broadly mind-brain issues and cognitive neuroscience, including the application of modern functional neuroimaging methods to intensive psychophysiological studies of psi and altered states of consciousness. He is presently research professor at the Department of Psychiatric Medicine, Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. And he's a co-author of two classic books, Beyond Physicalism, Toward Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality, and Irreducible Mind, Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century. Welcome to Signs of Life, Ed.
Glad to be here.
And, you know, I mentioned, you have that terrible education pedigree. I'm glad to see you're able to overcome that, you know.
Well put, yeah.
Yeah.
I managed to avoid the hardening of the categories, as they say.
Yeah. I say that jokingly, but, you know, it really is important that people are aware that there are very well-credentialed researchers in this field that study survival, consciousness, and the mind-body—you know— problem. And we face such a stigma still today, of people, thinking of this as woo-woo stuff, you know. And I guess that's a battle that you and your colleagues have been fighting, you know, for decades now, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Since the very founding of the Society for Psychical Research back in 1882 in England, even though the membership of the society is a large part of the intellectual aristocracy as well as the social aristocracy of England at that time.
Mm.
And, of course, now a lot of times critics like to portray us as a bunch of ignorant fools, and it's just not true. It's very hard to find reliable information about these subjects. Can't find it on Wikipedia. Can't get it out of your average media, because all of these kind of communication systems are mired in the current mainstream view of how mind and brain work, which is basically that we're just complicated biological machines. Neurophysiological processes in the brain produce mind and consciousness, and when you die, it's all over. Lights out, end of story.
Mm.
And we get that from the time we're in kindergarten until graduate school.
And I'm sure you got that while you were studying cognitive science at Harvard. I mean,
you bet.
Yeah.
Well, even though I was working at William James Hall at the time, I don't think more than a half a dozen of the many inhabitants of that building had any idea that William James devoted a large part of his mature intellectual life to the study of mediumship and related things.
Mm. So what was it that moved you away from the materialistic way of thinking into pondering the nature of psi and consciousness?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I certainly was a physicalist myself. You just kind of absorbed it out of the atmosphere in graduate school. Not that we talked about it or argued about it or anything. It was just what everybody believed. And then late in graduate school, I was working on my dissertation. I had a call one day from my mother, who informed me that a female relative of ours had turned into a medium, and my mother was clearly worried about that, and she apparently figured that since I was a graduate student in psychology, I'd be able to reassure her. Well, I didn't have the slightest idea at the time what she was talking about. I had to go over to the library to find out, and it was really at that point that I learned about William James's own larger interests, also encountered the Journal of Parapsychology, where people were publishing experimental studies of the same sort that I was learning to do in graduate school. So it was really at that point that I started looking into the subject, and I quickly became almost perfectly convinced, based on what I read, that, well, this stuff, it's for real, and if it is for real, it has big implications for how the world is put together, because it can't be explained, I believe, in terms of the prevailing view of things.
Mm.
So that's what started it.
and the rest is history. I mean,
yeah.
I know that you were heavily influenced by the work of Myers, so and you still, you know, refer to him, you know, in your work. And what's interesting about Myers is that, you know, one of his books, the classic, you know, Human Personality and its Survival of Bodily Death. So I was always, you know, intrigued by that, because if it's the personality that survives, that tends to refute the concept that people are only extracting data, you know, from an information source.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, how do you extract personality?
And I have to say that, you know, as a beginning parapsychology person, I was somewhat familiar with that book, not very. I knew of its existence, and I had read some of the early proceedings of the SPR, Society for Psychical Research. But I then turned to experimental stuff. I went to work for J.B. Ryan down in Durham. He had left the psychology department at Duke, moved across the street, basically set up his own little research institute. And as it happened, I wasn't there more than about a month before I met a guy who could do anything we asked him to do experimentally. And this guy quickly erased any doubts that I had about the reality of the basic phenomena, things like telepathy and clairvoyance and so on. But, you know, at that time, I still, I guess like most mainstream kind of scientists, I really kind of hoped that a little adjustment here and there might sort of somehow allow for these phenomena to be explained in more or less conventional ways. And it's taken a long time for me to really move to the other end of the spectrum, basically, where now I think that we're going to have to totally upend our most fundamental ideas about the relationship between mind and consciousness on the one hand and matter on the other. I'm a little unusual in this at DOPS. I'm not going to name names, but I think we're kind of divided on how far one really has to go in this direction. But I'm personally just about convinced at this point that there's no place to stop once you abandon conventional materialism, short of some kind of absolute idealism or something very close to that.
Mm.
And there are several new books that are going to come out either late this year or early next, all written by guys who are deeply versed in contemporary physical theory, but who have had big mystical experiences which have convinced them that consciousness is primary and that matter must somehow be secondary to it rather than the other way around. So these I think, are going to make some waves in the mainstream scientific community. I don't know. I can mention the names if that would be helpful. One is a man named Federico Fagin. He's an Italian physicist, and he's best known in this country as one of the major pioneers of the whole microelectronics industry. He invented several of the early microprocessors. But it turns out that for decades he's been having mystical experiences, the very first of which convinced him that what he'd been taught about the fundamental nature of reality in physics courses was not right. So he's writing his version of an idealistic theory. Another guy is a man named Bernardo Kastrup, who's a computer engineer by training. A very skillful guy, worked at CERN for a while, with the LHC and all that kind of stuff. He had mystical experiences arrived at by a somewhat different route, but he's arrived at quite similar ideas. And the third is Paul Marshall, who's one of the chapter authors of our book Beyond Physicalism, who also had a spontaneous mystical experience several decades ago that diverted him from the study of physics into the study of religions. So these are going to be big events. These are all super smart, super informed guys who are bucking the mainstream in a way I think the mainstream is going to find harder to ignore than people like me.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, there have been some books written by physicists already, and there seems to be, as you mentioned, more to come. And it's always interesting when you have these, what you think of as hardcore, you know, physicists start sounding, they're spiritualists. The two don't seem.
At least certainly interested in spiritual things and open to all the paranormal stuff as well.
Yeah. I often wondered, I mean, there have been so many technological advances in brain research, and all you hear about is brain mapping, which they're using to explain all sorts of things. And I wonder if this is reinforcing the mainstream idea that consciousness can be, you know, explained by electrochemical processes, or are all these new studies causing some scientists and researchers to, you know, explore other non-physical explanations? I don't know where it's leading us. I guess it's both ways, you know, you might say.
Well, yeah, it's very hard to tell, of course, without doing, constant surveys and that sort of thing. But as you say, it can be read both ways. There are people who have become skeptical of the possibility of explaining things as basic as consciousness in terms of brain processes. And these include some really influential neuroscientists. For example, Christoph Koch, you know, he wrote his biography, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist, a book about consciousness. And in that book, he comes right out and he says on page 119, "I used to believe that consciousness was manufactured by physiological processes in the brain. I no longer believe that." That's an enormous concession and step away from the prevailing orthodoxy. And there are several other people who are sort of following him down that path. There's also a big movement in the world of philosophy of mind. I have some friends who go to a lot of meetings in that area, and they are convinced that conventional physicalism is rapidly failing as a metaphysical position. This is the kind of basic philosophical underpinning of the contemporary mainstream psychology and neuroscience, certainly. And that most people in the philosophy world now are more interested in trying to figure out what will replace it rather than defending it. So there really is a kind of something is in the air. Things, I think, are really starting to move. And going back to your first observation, I mean, of course, all this stuff, which is everywhere, you know, even in popular magazines and so on, you see pictures of brains with little colored spots on them and somebody saying that, well, that colored spot explains this, that, or the other thing. Well, all those things are really correlations between brain activity and something mental. And a lot of people in the mainstream would like to interpret that correlation as the physical thing producing the mental thing. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. This was pointed out by William James over 100 years ago. He said there are other kinds of correlations. And in fact, he advanced the idea, which I believe is profoundly correct, that the way it works instead is that mind and consciousness are something ontologically different from the brain. They work in conjunction with the brain normally, but are not produced by it. So the brain activity conditions what mind and consciousness do, but doesn't create it. And in fact, Irreducible Mind, our first book, was an extended defense of that point of view. And you see, once I think that's correct, and if you accept that, suddenly the door to survival opens in a way that it would not be open if that view were not correct. Because if the mainstream guys are right that mind and consciousness are generated by physiology, then when the physiology goes, mind and personality go, for sure.
Right.
But we have a good bit of direct evidence for survival. And this picture, the James picture of the way mind and brain operate together, allows for that. That was the big thing in my case, by the way, that kind of moved me from where I started out in this field toward openness to survival. Not that this matters particularly what any one person thinks about it, but I personally come to think it's quite likely that survival exists, and I pretty much expect to find myself in some other state of being when I die.
Yeah, and I know that you and your team at DOPS are very interested in survival phenomena, and I know, including Dr. Emily Kelly, who's a brilliant researcher in her own right, and also happens to be your spouse. You guys are also interested in mediumship. So here's the thing. Previous research has already been established that there's compelling evidence that some people, you know, can communicate with discarnate entities. I think that's already been shown by multiple studies. And the next wave of research appears to be heading in a direction of how mediums can do what they do. And one way is by studying what happens in the brain when a subject is in an altered state of consciousness. So my oversimplification, the question in lay terms is that if it's the mind that's the conduit, that allows the communication and not the physical brain, you know, might we be barking up the wrong tree? I mean, might we be examining the filter and not flows what into, you know, what flows into the filter?
Well, I don't think so. Let me preface this by saying that we can't be terribly sure about any of these kinds of things, but just to indicate how I think about it, the idea is that like I said, if you think of mind and consciousness as operating normally in connection with the brain, what they can do depends on the functional condition of the brain. If you think about dreaming, in dreaming we create whole worlds, even though we have very little connection to the present physical environment. On the picture I sketched, the James picture, in normal waking consciousness, we're really, in a certain way, dreaming, but in a way that's constrained by the sensory input we get through our brain. You know, our brain is constantly taking in information about the immediate surroundings. But on the James view, the mind and consciousness have other sources of input that they can access. And this is very Myers-like, by the way. He felt that deeper levels of the mind were constantly in touch with a much wider environment. So what I would suggest to you is that in studying the physiology of mediumship, we are looking into conditions in the brain that allow these deeper parts of the psyche to express themselves more efficiently than they normally can. And in fact, I really believe that over the coming decades, we're going to learn a whole lot more about that and get a whole lot better at creating those conditions. You know, people have stumbled into mediumship. There's a whole vast literature, cross-cultural literature, about the 90% of the 4,000 or whatever preliterate societies have established kind of institutional means for producing altered states of consciousness, which they regard as valuable because the people who can enter those states can do things like healing, divination, recovery of lost articles, all that kind of stuff, which is socially valuable. And we know from that literature that they must place a lot of value on these things because the kinds of procedures that people subject themselves in order to enter the states are really, they're pretty horrific. They can involve, fasting, deprivation of not only food, but water, sleep, all kinds of rituals, rhythmic clapping, chanting, drumming, that goes on sometimes for days at a time at high intensity. They may involve ingestion of psychoactive substances of one or another sort, and they can be quite dangerous, actually, for people who do these things. But they do it because the states are so valuable to their social groups.
Yeah, it's almost as if we're trying to rediscover something that the ancients knew.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And what the ancients knew is probably a good bit less than we can learn using modern scientific methods about what needs to happen and how to make that happen.
Yeah.
My hope is that we'll develop much more efficient, benign kinds of ways of making these states accessible to more people. And I think that's a realistic possibility.
Why is that important? I mean, why is it important for us to learn about these non-physical phenomena? What's the big picture here?
Oh boy. At the risk of offending some people's political sensibilities and that sort of thing, I personally think we're headed toward catastrophe, driven to a considerable extent by the worldview that came into being with the ascent of modern science, which threw out the baby with the bathwater. There were lots of superstitions to be discarded, but it has tended, as witnessed, by the way, by Steven Pinker's new book. Have you seen this book, Enlightenment Now?
No.
It's basically a pitch for the narrowest kind of Enlightenment rationalism, claims that things are really getting better and better despite appearances, and that we just have to give up any ideas of any kind of transcendent environment or non-physical anything in the world, and we'll be okay. But he says, among other things, that any idea of a non-physical psyche or soul has to be wrong because it predicts the existence of paranormal phenomena, of which he apparently knows nothing. So,
yeah,
that's the situation we're in. And my hope is that the kind of world, scientifically grounded worldview that we've been driving toward in our books opens a way to a much healthier kind of society, one which can accommodate spiritual realities no less than the material ones.
Yeah, I often want, ponder that, and as I agree with you, and we live in a world today, it's divided, it's besieged by war, there's crime, there's famine, there's bigotry, there's ecological decay, and with all those things in mind, does that make one more likely to ponder the big picture? To search for other meaning, or does it have the opposite effect of causing one to just throw up their hands and reinforce the concept that we're all, we all are individual island dwellers with no connection to each other and, no non-physical forces?
Right.
I think that more people are going in the other direction, that they're pondering greater meaning,
I hope that's true. I certainly have the sense that there's a lot of interest out there and receptiveness to different ways of thinking about things. And actually, a lot of the resistance is concentrated in a small cadre of professional deniers, guys like Michael Shermer and the amazingly Randy and people like that.
Yeah.
And more recently, Sean Carroll, the physicist, goes around declaring that psi phenomena are ruled out by the laws of physics, therefore they can't happen. I don't have to look at any evidence. And these guys get a lot of public attention. They have access to media, other kinds of outlets, get lots of financial support from I don't know where.
Yeah.
But every time we go to any kind of public forum, it's obvious that people are just really interested in the kinds of things we study and the implications of the things we study.
Absolutely. And we see that even in our own foundation, you know, it just grows and grows and grows, and it grows globally, and the people are interested, you know, and it's not stopping. We're talking with Dr. Edward Kelly, co-author of two tremendously informative books, Irreducible Mind Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century, Beyond Physicalism Towards Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality. We have lots more to talk about when we come back from the break. Maybe Ed can talk about the place where he works and the colleagues that he has at the University of Virginia.
Oh, good.
So stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Am I Psychic is a mobile app designed using statistics, science, and parapsychological protocols to test psychic ability using fun games. Each game has two unique modes. In psychokinesis mode, influence the game using mind over matter ability. In extrasensory perception mode, guess which random option will be chosen. Am I Psychic can store your results in an anonymous database used to eventually publish in academic journals. Available on the App Store and Google Play. Go to amipsychicapp.com and be a part of proving psychic phenomena to the world. Some profits will be donated to the Rhine Research Center.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's Hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love knows no death. A groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the ForeverFamilyFoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Just tuning in, we have been talking to Dr. Ed Kelly. Our sponsor is the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. Here are some updates from Forever Family Foundation events and happenings. We want to remind everybody, check the events page on our website regularly. That's foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And just to let our listeners know about our free events coming up next month in April, on April 8th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, the Afterlife Discussion Group in Sanibel, Florida meets. On April 14th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, 11 noon Pacific, Visionary Explorers Group meets online. April 14th again from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern, the Afterlife Discussion Group in Miami, Florida meets. Our Holiday of the Earth Raffle 2018 drawing is next month. Win up to 5 medium readings with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Amy Utzman, Angelina Diana, Dustin Livers, Rebecca Ann LaCicero, and Dave Campbell. The drawing is set for Earth Day, April 22nd. Winners are selected randomly by a computer program from consecutive numbers assigned at entry. It's only $5 to enter. The early bird rates of our afterlife luncheon set for May 6th. End on March 31st. It's in a few days. So you may want to reserve those seats now for a full 5-hour day with two very special people who have all the answers about the afterlife. Lloyd Auerbach, one of the world's leading parapsychologists and respected expert on ghost hauntings and poltergeist phenomena, teams up with Forever Family Foundation certified medium Kim Russo, star of the TV series The Haunting of. And she will connect with those in spirit who will lead her to their loved ones in the audience. Plan to be at the Hilton Long Island Huntington in Melville, New York, for this full day, which includes a scrumptious luncheon. Our next webinar is set for April 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern, and you don't want to miss this one. It's Huck Berry Presents Shamanic Cosmology and Visioning. The webinars are $6 for members and $20 for non-members. If you are considering attending our next summer grief retreat in Chester, Connecticut, you probably do not want to wait. There are only 50 spots. Registration has been brisk for this August 17th through 19th weekend. Details and registration links are on our website. Watch your email boxes for a special weekend in Fort Myers, Florida, this coming November 9th through 11th, when our social network feature Mediums Behind the Scenes goes live. And please, please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. Ed Kelly. And Ed, I guess it's fair to say that there aren't many major universities in the world that house such a sophisticated, you know, division that studies the mind-body problem and evidence of survival. So tell us a little bit about, well, we call it DOPS, but what is DOPS and what are you interested in?
Okay. Well, DOPS currently stands for the Division of Perceptual Studies. It's a slightly odd name. We chose it to preserve the acronym when our former chairman of our department decided that the previous name, Division of Personality Studies, was not suitable for a modern psychiatry department because of that word personality, which is too archaic from his point of view. Anyway, the division was founded initially in 1967, I guess, by Ian Stevenson, who had recently become the chairman at a quite young age. He was already a very distinguished guy. He's a force of nature, really, who in his lifetime produced something like 13 books and 300 and some odd scientific papers. And he has been principally identified with the study of what we call cases of the reincarnation type, meaning small children who begin to speak and act as though they're remembering events from a previous life that you is recent enough that you can kind of check up on things. See if you can identify a person corresponding to the child's memories or physical condition. You know, sometimes these kids have birthmarks or birth defects, often of a very unusual kind that turn out to correspond to fatal wounds on the body of the previous personality. Anyway, Ian and his colleagues over almost 50 years have identified something like 2,500 such cases, most of which are now encoded in a big database so that we can begin to do statistical and modeling type studies of the phenomenon, trying to predict, for example, or discover what factors predict how many memories a child will express or how long it is between the time of death and the rebirth, things of that sort. So that's one big area of research. Then, and Jim Tucker is carrying that on. He's now the chief of our division, carrying on Ian's work and focusing mainly on American cases. For example, you probably heard about the Leininger, James Leininger case of a small kid who seemed to remember having been shot down as an Air Force pilot over, where was it, Iwo Jima or someplace, I forget, in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Anyway, then Bruce Grayson, who's the previous division chief, succeeding Ian, has worked for four decades or so on near-death experiences. And these occur under lots of circumstances, but the some of the most interesting ones are circumstances such as deep general anesthesia and or cardiac arrest, in which the physiological conditions that most scientists think are necessary for conscious experience have been abolished, and yet people not only report experiences, but the most intense and transformative experiences of their entire lives. And Bruce has about 1,000 cases in his collection, similarly now embodied in a big computer database that we can begin to do statistical analysis and modeling with. Emily, my wife, is in a semi-retired state, but she's worked on everything that goes on in the division, and by the way, has a very good book about Ian Stevenson and his work. It includes a whole lot of his, or excerpts from a lot of his major works, and also editorial glue to hold it all together. It's called Science, Survival, and the Self, about Ian. Let's see, a new person now occupying what used to be Ian's chair is Kim Pemberthy, and she's been working mainly in the area of meditation and its effect on various physiological things, but she's gradually moving into the central part of DOPS's interests, focusing really on meditation and its impact on things like spontaneous psi events, stuff of that sort. And then I and my colleagues run a neuroimaging laboratory. It's a state-of-the-art EEG lab, and we now have capacity to do functional near-infrared spectroscopy. That's a big mouthful, but it uses light shine through the skull to measure the same sort of things that are usually measured nowadays using MRI machines, functional MRI. So it looks at things like the oxygenation status and amount of blood flow. And we're interested in studying people who have not only psi abilities, but also who can enter these various kinds of unusual states of consciousness that we know or believe to be psi-conducive, including things like mediumship, especially trans-mediumship, if we can find any trans-mediums, people who are hypnotic virtuosos or meditative adepts, or people who can voluntarily leave their body and go to a agreed-upon remote location. So those are all the kinds of things that we want to study. And by the way, I should mention that anybody who wants to find out more about DOPS can just Google on DOPS, D-O-P-S, blank, UVA. And that'll take you right to our website, and you'll find tons of information there, including all kinds of papers and descriptions of ongoing research and all that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah, well, thanks for that. And of course, many of the researchers that you mentioned, I mean, Jim Tucker's been on the show several times, and people can go in our archives and hear his interviews, as well as, you know, Bruce Grayson. So these mm-hmm. are the top people in the world in their specialties. And
absolutely. I think it's fair to say, Bob, that DOPS is really the oldest and most productive university-based research program in the world, devoted exclusively to these kinds of phenomena that fundamentally challenge the prevailing physicalism.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I, there are so many things to talk about with you in so little time, but, you know, you wrote that for an enlarged scientific picture of the human mind and personality to emerge, two things need to happen. One, it must be demonstrated that the currently dominant physicalist theories of mind-brain relations are inadequate in principle. And two, an alternative theory must be found that remedies these defects. So which of these two things have we made more progress toward?
Well, Irreducible Mind addressed the first task, and I think succeeded for those who will take the trouble to study it. The second book, Beyond Physicalism, addresses the second, not with such decisive success, I think, but certainly pointing in a general direction that I believe is viable and that we can continue to develop through additional research along similar lines. So that's the whole story. I should really send you, if I haven't done it already, I wrote a kind of brief description of the whole 15-year project that led to those two books. Kind of summarizes the whole thing in four pages, which is better than the, 1,500 pages of the two books combined.
I know. And I'll mention to our listeners, Irreducible Mind, as Ed said, I mean, it is, I have it right in front of me, and I think it is somewhere around 1,500 pages. But every once in a while, I'll pick it up, and I would recommend that if you could find your way to get a copy of the book. It's not cheap, but there's a lot of, you know, there's so much information in it. I was reading a chapter the other day that Emily wrote and about Myers and his view of hysteria and genius, and it opened up all sorts of questions. So I'm going to have to get Emily on the radio one of these days, because I have so many things to ask her. But
all right, I'll let her know.
But meanwhile, I thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back again so we can continue this conversation. As Ed mentioned, you can Google DOPS, the Division of Perceptual Studies, and learn a lot more about their work. Thanks so much, Ed, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Great. Be happy to do it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from all participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon Kat Barad, Robin Murray, Ashley Jackson, Matt Mello, and Fred Folger. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. To love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say...
Our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.